Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Well, I love being in Nashville. This is a place I come to often, and the reason is sitting on the front row. My son, my daughter-in-law, my two grandchildren, Roxy and Max. I want to thank the Nashville Public Library, Mayor Dean, and Parnassus Books so much for bringing me here and for what you're doing with this wonderful series, and I'm very honored to be part of it. The invention of wings begins with these four paragraphs. There was a time in Africa the people could fly. My mama told me this when I was 10 years old. She said, handful. Your granny mama saw it for herself. She say they flew over trees and clouds. She say they flew like blackbirds. When we came here, we left that magic behind. My mama was shrewd. She didn't get any reading and writing like me. Everything she knew came from living on the scarce side of mercy. She looked at my face, how it flowed with sorrow and doubt. She said, you don't believe me? Where you think these shoulder blades of yours come from, girl? Those skinny bones stuck out from my back like nubs. She patted them and said, this all what left of your wings, just these flat bones. But one day, you gonna get them back. I was shrewd like mama. Even at 10, I knew this story about people flying was pure malarkey. We weren't some special people who lost our magic. We were slave people, and we weren't going anywhere. It was later I saw what she meant. We could fly all right, but there wasn't any magic to it. These opening lines of the novel are in the voice of my character, Hetty Handful Grimke, an enslaved woman in early 19th century Charleston. And I wanted to quote them to you because, in a way, they contain the distilled essence of the whole novel. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you don't need to read the book, but this essence is there pointing to the meaning of the story, which has to do with our quest for freedom. It has to do with our ability to transcend, with our ability to invent our wings, so to speak. In 2007, I went to the Brooklyn Museum in New York to the Judy Chicago Dinner Party exhibit. Now, at the time, I was writing a memoir with my daughter, Anne Kidd Taylor, traveling with pomegranates. I was in the midst of that, and I wasn't really looking for a novel idea. As I was in the museum, I happened to look at the heritage panels outside the exhibit, where they have listed 999 names of women who have made significant contributions to American history. Not American history, Western history, really. I mean, some of them, many of them are American. And as I was looking, to my husband's dismay, at all 999 names, I came upon the name of two sisters. Now, the only vague idea I had about a next novel was that it would be about two sisters. That was a very sketchy idea, and maybe it's because I had three brothers that I wanted to write about two sisters. But I didn't know who those sisters were or where they lived or when they lived or anything about them. It was just the barest little seed of an idea. And when I came upon the name of these two sisters on the heritage panels, I paused a long time because their names were Sarah and Angelina Grimke, and they were from Charleston, South Carolina, where I was then living. And I had never heard of them. It was said on the panel that they were early abolitionists, female abolition agents, actually, and that they were early feminist rights pioneers, women's rights pioneers. So I went home determined to find out everything I could about Sarah and Angelina Grimke. It just seemed completely wrong that I had never heard of them. I like to think that I had read a lot about women's studies and women's history. As it turned out, I had been driving by the Grimke sisters' unmarked house in Charleston for 10 years and did not know who they were. In fact, they weren't all that well known in Charleston, even, it seemed to me, at that time. And yet, they were the first female abolition agents in America. They were not just pioneers for women's rights. Angelina was the first woman in America to speak before a legislative body. And Sarah was the first woman to write what you might call a feminist manifesto in this country. Long before Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott initiated the first women's rights convention in America, these two sisters, 10 years earlier, were out there fighting the first battle in our country for women's rights. And I was so struck by them. I was frankly captivated by their history and what they had accomplished. You know that saying, well-behaved women never make history? It's true. Sarah and Angelina in the 1830s were arguably the most misbehaved women in America. Few women from Charleston have ever misbehaved so wonderfully as these two women. They could, I think, be called the most radical women to come out of antebellum South, possibly. So I fell in love with them. And one of the reasons is because they underwent this very long, painful metamorphosis to accomplish what they did. And I was pretty impressed. They had to give up their family, their homeland, their traditions, their religion. They had to leave everything. They became pariahs in Charleston, and they became exiles in the North. And I was very moved, especially by Sarah. Here's a Southern abolitionist who desperately wanted to make a difference in the world. She was keenly intelligent. She had the most acute moral compass, and she wanted to have a vocation. She was born, in 1792. She wanted a voice in the world. And she was crushed at every turn because she was female. And I loved how human she was. She was utterly human. She had to struggle to get her courage up every time. But almost from the first moment that I decided, this is the story I want to tell. I want to tell the story of these two sisters. I knew immediately that I would need to tell and want to tell the story of an enslaved woman to entwine their stories together. And it mattered deeply to me that both worlds be there. I was daunted by this, very daunted. I said to myself, if I can't do this, then I won't write this novel. That's how important it seemed to me. Then I came upon something interesting. I discovered in Sarah's journals that she had been given a waiting maid when she was probably 11 or 12 years old. And this was a fairly common custom to give a young girl, an enslaved girl, to be her waiting maid. Sarah didn't particularly want this gift at all. But she received this gift, and her name was Hetty. And all we really know about Hetty is that she was taught to read by Sarah, which was against the law in South Carolina. And she was, she died young, probably in her early adolescence. She's just a little footnote in history. And I read that and I thought, that's the other half of the story. I wanted to imagine a life for her. I wanted to give her a voice and a story, and I knew it had to be comparable in weight and substance to Sarah's story. And again, that was daunting for me. Now, the funny thing was, or maybe the curious thing, is that Hetty's voice came to me with more accessibility than Sarah's. This I did not expect. Hetty, her name is, I call her Hetty Handful, and you'll find out why soon enough. She would talk in my mind with a lot of ease that was surprising to me. And I cannot explain this, really, except to say that it might have something to do with the fact that Sarah came with this large historical script that I had to adhere to, and I was pretty, I wanted to be very respectful of that script, and I wanted to get it all in, so I got tied to it pretty good. But Handful had free rein of my imagination, and I could sort of let her go, and so she had a lot to say. Writing from this intersection where history and imagination intersect turned out to be a very interesting challenge for me. I'd never written a historical novel before. I'm always amused when people refer to The Secret Life of Bees as a historical novel, since I was alive in 1964. But I wanted to weave fact and fiction together, and I wanted to tell this thickly imagined story about Sarah Grimke. And so I had to free her up. I had to find her in my imagination the way I found Hetty, and as well as in history. So it became this interweaving, really, of a great deal of factual material in history, along with my imagined events that I grafted onto her history, mostly in her relationship to Hetty Handful. My primary goal was just to serve the story. I wanted to give my readers a story, and yet the history is very foundational here, the chronology, what was going on in the 19th century. I tried very hard to render it with very precise accuracy and to make sure that readers who might not know Sarah Grimke and her sister would come away understanding her life and the major events in her life and the turning points in her life and what she did and accomplished. Well, it spans 35 years. It has a lot of characters, and about all I can really do is just try to introduce you briefly to Hetty and Sarah, the two narrators of the story, who go back and forth narrating their lives. I like to begin my novels in what Joseph Campbell, the mythologer, called the ordinary world. I always start them there. And then very quickly, a call to adventure comes that will pull them out of their ordinary worlds into this series of events, of narrative events that will compose the story, really. Well, I'm going to read a couple of brief passages from The Invention of Wings from the voice of Hetty Handful, who is in her ordinary world. The year is 1803. The place is Charleston, South Carolina, and when this scene takes place, Hetty Handful is 10 years old. Already that morning, Mrs. had taken her cane stick to me once across my backside for falling asleep during her devotions. Every day, all us slaves, everyone but Rosetta, who was old and demented, jammed in the dining room before breakfast to fight off sleep, while Mrs. taught us short Bible verses like Jesus wept and prayed out loud about God's favorite subject, obedience. If you nodded off, you got whacked right in the middle of God said this and God said that. I was full of sass to Aunt Sister about the whole miserable business. I'd say, let this cup pass from me. Spouting one of Mrs. Verses, I'd say, Jesus wept because he's trapped in there with Mrs. like us. Aunt Sister was the cook. She'd been with Mrs. since Mrs. was a girl. And next to Tomfrey, the butler, she ran the whole show. She was the only one who could tell Mrs. what to do without getting smacked by the cane. Mama said, watch your tongue. But I never did. Aunt Sister popped me backward 3 times a day. I was a handful. That's not how I got my name, though. Handful was my basket name. The master and missus, they did all the proper naming. But Mama would look on her baby when it was laid in its basket, and a name would come to her. Something about what her baby looked like, what day of the week it was, what the weather was doing, or just how the world seemed on that day. My mama's basket name was Summer, but her proper name was Charlotte. She had a brother whose basket name was Hard Time. People think I make that up, but it's true as can be. If you got a basket name, you at least had something from your mama. Master Grimke named me Hetty, but Mama looked on me the day I was born, how I came in the world too soon, and she called me Handful. This next passage comes shortly after Handful is given as a gift to Sarah on Sarah's 11th birthday. Now, I don't know exactly how Sarah received this gift. I conjured up this notion that she was a birthday present, and she appears at this birthday party festooned in all these lavender ribbons. This event, by the way, is, in my mind at least, the call to adventure in the story. It's the catalyst that will begin the arc of events in the story, and it will link these two characters together for the rest of their lives, and they will shape each other's lives and destinies after this. So this scene comes as Hetty is trying to get the hang of being a waiting maid. Mrs. said I was the worst waiting maid in Charleston. She said, you are abysmal, Hetty, abysmal. I asked Miss Sarah what abysmal means, and she said, not quite up to standard. I could tell from Mrs.'s face, there's bad, there's worse, and after that comes abysmal. That first week beside the smoke, I spilled oil lamp on the floor, leaving a slick spot. Broke one of those porcelain vases and fried a piece of Miss Sarah's red hair with a curling tong. Miss Sarah never tattled. She tugged the rug over to cover the oily place, hid the broke porcelain in a storeroom in the cellar, and cut off her singed hair with the sniffer we used to snip the candle wick. Only time Miss Sarah rang her bell for me was if Mrs. was headed our way. Miss Sarah's warning bell gave me some extra lead on my rope, and I took it. I would rove down the hallway to the front alcove where I could see the water in the harbor float to the ocean and the ocean roll on till it sloshed against the sky. Nothing could hold a glory-bound picture to it. First time I saw it, my feet hopped in place and I lifted my hand over my head and danced. That's when I got true religion. I didn't know to call it religion back then. Didn't know amen from what when. I just knew something came into me that made me feel the water belonged to me. I would say, that's my water out there. I saw it turn every color. It was green one day, then brown, next day yellow as cider, purple, black, blue. It stayed restless, never ceasing, boats coming and going on top, fishes underneath. I would sing these little verses to it. Cross the water, cross the sea, let them fishes carry me. If my water take too long, carry me on, carry me on. After a month or two of doing more things right in the house, Miss Sarah didn't know. Some nights I left my post by her door and watched the water all night long, the way it broke silver from the moon, the stars shining big as platters. I could see clean to Sullivan's Island. I pined for Mama when it was dark. I missed our bed. I missed the quilt frame guarding over us. I pictured Mama sewing quilts by herself. I would think about the gunny sack stuffed with feathers, the red pouch with our pins and needles, my pure brass thimble. Nights like that, I hightailed it back to the stable room. Every time Mama woke and found me in bed with her, she had a fit saying all the trouble there would be if I got caught, how I already lived too far out on Mrs. Badside. "Ain't nothing good gonna come from you wandering off like this," she said. "You got to stay put on your quilt. You do that for me, you hear?" And I'd do it for her, at least for a while. I'd lay on the floor in the hall, trying to stay warm in the draft, twisting round in search of the softest floorboard. I could make do with that misery and take my solace from the water. When someone says slavery, what comes to mind? I think for a lot of Americans, it is plantation slavery, you know, particularly some of the old myths from literature and movies that get in your head about magnolias and moonlight and cotton fields and slave cabins. And, you know, it's sad that we romanticize some of that, actually. This novel attempts to look at something quite differently than that's urban slavery. And I don't know that we're as familiar with urban slavery, or at least as readily as we are with plantation slavery. Charleston, in the early 19th century particularly, was the crown jewel of the South. I mean, it was a city, a great urban center, actually, a harbor center, with a lot of wealth, a lot of opulence, and the most amazing structure of hierarchy I have ever come upon. The city was alive with networks of rumors passed from enslaved person to enslaved person, from workyard to workyard, because the streets teemed with the enslaved population. There were as many enslaved people in Charleston as there was a white population. And you had a system that operated on two things, surveillance and control. So there would be city guard, passes, badges, ordinances, all kinds of things. And I came upon something called the workhouse, which was very disturbing to come upon. I had not heard of this until I began researching this novel. It was a place where slaves could be sent for punishment. A so-called owner could buy 20 lashes for $5 in Charleston. So it was in this environment that the novel takes place. It was a time when one of the largest and least known slave plots in American history was hatched right in the heart of Charleston, the Denmark Vesey slave insurrection plot. And if it had actually succeeded, every one of us would have studied this in school and known about it very, very easily. I decided to bring in this plot into the story and weave it with Sarah and with Handful and her mother Charlotte's lives. And I wanted to do this because it was important to me to suggest that depicting slaves as passive victims who were not invested in their own freedom is really a travesty. And I wanted to show this side of their history in which they labored and struggled for freedom and really plotted and died and resisted and subverted and did all kinds of things to free themselves. Now, I was as daunted by writing about something as large as American slavery as I was writing in the voice of an enslaved woman. And I suppose there are all kinds of mysteries about why a novelist will gravitate to a certain subject, you know, repeatedly. I wrote about civil rights in The Secret Life of Bees. And I wanted to return to this subject with this novel. I wanted to go back to the very roots of racism in our country, to ground zero, so to speak, to slavery. Because the legacy it left us is racism. It's where it started. And this very racialized society that I think we have, and I don't think we've fully taken care of that wound. It's a great American wound. And we could even say an American Holocaust in a way. And we've made amazing strides, but I think the legacy lingers. So I wanted to revisit it, and if possible, to start again a conversation about it. During my childhood, in the 50s and 60s, growing up in the South, I witnessed a lot of things, as I imagine some of you did, a lot of injustices and huge racial divides. I grew up with Rosa Parks, civil rights marches, and separate water fountains. This was the stuff of my history, and as I'm sure it might have been for some of you. Martin Luther King was born today. I was reminded driving through your streets. I saw banners about that, and I was thinking about how he was jailed in the town where I was born when I was 13 years old and was living 20 miles away at the time. So all of these things are part of the collective history. As the novelist James Baldwin said, race is a common history, and it's certainly the stuff of my history. Well, let me introduce you to Sarah and give you a glimpse of her ordinary world. This passage that I want to read comes the night after the birthday party, when she receives a handful as a gift. And this birthday party is also her, is also Sarah's call to adventure too, as you'll see. Sliding from my perch, I stole to the window where I shivered in my white woolen gown, gazing along East Bay past the dark rooftops toward the harbor. Plastering my cheek against the frigid pane, I discovered I had a partial view of the slave quarters above the carriage house, where I knew Hetty to be spending the last night with her mother. Tomorrow, she would take up her duties and sleep outside my door. It was then I had a certain epiphany. I lit a candle from the dwindling coals in the fire, opened my door, and stepped into the dark, unheated passageway. Three dark shapes lay on the floor beside the bedroom doors. I'd never really seen the world beyond the nursery at night, and it took a moment to realize the shapes were slaves, sleeping close by in case a Grimke rang his bell. I crept barefoot down the corridor, down the mahogany stairs, along with, and saw Cindy, who sat wide awake with her back against the wall outside my parents' chamber. She eyed me warily, but didn't ask what I was doing. I picked my way again the near length of the main passage, turned the knob to Father's library, and stepped inside. An ornately framed portrait of George Washington was lit with a scrim of moonlight coming from the front window. For almost a year, Father had looked the other way as I'd slipped beneath Mr. Washington's nose to plunder the library. John, Thomas, and Frederick had total reign over his vast trove, books of law, geography, philosophy, theology, history, botany, poetry, and the Greek humanities, while Mary and I were officially forbidden to read a word. Mary didn't seem to care for books, but I dreamed of them in my sleep. I loved them in a way I couldn't fully express even to Thomas. He pointed me to certain volumes and drilled me on Latin declensions. He was the only one who knew my desperation to acquire a true education beyond the one I received at the hands of Madame Ruffin, my tutor and French nemesis. She was a small, hot-tempered woman who wore a widow's cap with strings floating at her cheek, and when it was cold, a squirrely fur coat and tiny fur-lined shoes. She was known to line girls up on the idle bench for the smallest infraction and scream at them until they fainted. I despised her and her polite education for the female mind, which was composed of needlework, manners, drawing, basic reading, penmanship, piano, Bible, French, and enough arithmetic to add two and two. I thought it possible I might die from tracing teensy flowers on the pages of my art tablet. Once I wrote in the margin, "If I should die of this hard exercise, I wish these flowers to adorn my coffin." Madame Ruffin was not amused. I was made to stand on the idle bench where she ranted at my insolence and where I forced myself not to faint. Increasingly, during those classes, longing seized me, foreign, torrential aches that overran my heart. I wanted to know things, to become someone. Oh, to be a son. I adored Father because he treated me almost like I were a son, allowing me to slip in and out of his library. On that night, the coals in the library's fireplace lay cold and the smell of cigar smoke pooled in the air. Without effort, I located Father's South Carolina Justice of the Peace and Public Laws, which he himself had authored. I'd thumbed through it enough to know somewhere in the pages was a copy of a legal manumission document. Upon finding it, I took paper and quill from Father's desk and copied it. "I hereby certify that on this day, 26 November, 1803, in the city of Charleston, in the state of South Carolina, I set free from slavery Hetty Grimke and bestow this certificate of manumission upon her, Sarah Moore Grimke." What could Father do but make Hetty's freedom as legal and binding as her ownership? I was following a code of law he'd fashioned himself. I left my handiwork atop the backgammon box on his desk. Of course, this will not work. This scene hints at the other major motif in the novel, which is gender and women's rights. In the 1800s, a privileged woman like Sarah Grimke, white women were vastly limited. Women had very few rights, and in many cases, not even to their own children. Couldn't write a will, couldn't vote, couldn't have a vocation. They were considered in many ways the property of their husband. And I could go on. There's a long list of things women couldn't do then. It makes us really appreciate where we are now. It's important to say, though, and I tried to never lose sight of this as I was writing the novel, is that the lack of freedoms of women at the time could no way compare to the subjugation of enslaved people, enslaved women in particular. So just like I came of age in pre-civil rights South, I also came of age in pre-feminist America. In 1963, let's see, I would have been about 13, I guess. My math isn't good in my head, but young adolescent, freshman in high school, taking a home economics class, learning how to make a man's home into a castle. Do you remember that? That was the whole point of that class, as I recall. And I remember the day that they wrote the list of vocations for women on the blackboard. I remember this day because I had a deep and formidable desire to be a writer, and it wasn't on the roster. There were the typical things, teacher and nurse, librarian, the more traditional things at the time for women, and it was a short list. I remember that too. When I headed to college, what do you think I studied? Nursing. Now, I have to say, I can hardly think of a more noble profession than that. I think it is an amazing way to spend your life. And now we have male nurses, too. I love that. But it wasn't my place of belonging. I didn't really belong to that. Luckily, I never killed anyone. I did become a nurse. I think this is one reason I identify with Sarah. Because, like Sarah, I did not know how, at that time, to think and act outside of the world that shaped me. And this is a huge quest for women, often, to learn to do that. It took me 8 years after graduating from college to break out and begin to find my own voice, my own consciousness, my own awareness of the world, and to shape my own soul, so to speak. I had many failures of courage doing that, just like Sarah. I love her for that she had many failures of courage, and she was slow to take her leap, often like I was. There's this moment in the novel where Handful says to Sarah, "My body might be a slave, but not my mind. For you, it's the other way round." And this is Sarah's quest for freedom. She had to liberate her mind. She had to liberate her spirit. So her invention of her wings had to do with this discovery of her own self, with a capital S, which I have found in my life to be a quintessential quest for many women. And not only to come to that sense of self, but to have the boldness to articulate that self in the world. This one last paragraph I want to read by Sarah takes place on the cusp of her public crusade. It's the moment when she has been tapped to be the first female abolition agent in America. And it is something that makes her pause. I stared at the black plank of rafter over my head, and it came to me that what I feared was not speaking. That fear was old and tired. What I feared was the immensity of it all. A female abolition agent, traveling the country with a national mandate. I wanted to say, "Who am I to do this? A woman." But that voice was not mine. It was Father's voice. It was Thomas's. It belonged to Israel, to Catherine, and to Mother. It belonged to the church in Charleston and the Quakers in Philadelphia, and it would not, if I could help it, belong to me. There's one thing I wanted to get across in this novel, and that is that in America, women became aware of the injustice of their own oppression by fighting for the rights of others. This is how it happened. And the Grimkes were the ones who linked abolition and women's rights. They were the ones who lit the fuse, and in the novel I call them female incendiaries. They fought for a woman's right to speak in the public sphere to mixed audiences. And I'm not talking race, I'm talking gender. Women could not speak publicly to an audience with men in it at the time. It was completely unheard of. A woman's place was in the domestic sphere, and they were fighting against a lot of backlash to be able to do that. There's a line in the novel that I loved writing, and I wanted to tell it to you so that if you read the novel and you come to it, you'll know that's my favorite line in the novel. It's just four words, and I gave it to Lucretia Mott to send in a letter to Sarah and Angelina at the very height of backlash against them, and these words are, "Press on, my sisters." My daughter said, I'm going to get that tattooed on my ankle. Right. I said, I don't think so. No. I've been asked what I hope readers will take from this novel. It's been out a week now, and I've gotten this question more times than you can imagine. It would please me a lot if readers would learn something, you know, enlighten the mind a little about maybe 19th century history, or rediscover Sarah and Angelina Grimke, or what, or something about urban slavery. Or you like your novel to be a carrier of ideas, right? And I do. But I think what I really would wish for is that the readers would have a felt experience of the story. In other words, that a reader might feel what it's like to be an enslaved person, or feel what it's like to be a woman with no rights. Taking another's experience and making it your own is one of the most mysterious transactions the human soul can have, actually. It's called empathy. And it is the real power of fiction, both writing it and reading it. When I was in college, I studied the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson, great American thinker. And his concept of the common heart, which he described as this place inside of us where we share an intrinsic unity with all humanity. It's that place where we're all one, we're connected, that empathetic place. This idea has remained with me my whole life. And as a writer, as a novelist, I have to believe in that place. As a human being, I believe in that place. And I think my greatest wish would be that my work would become a portal that would allow readers to go to that place, to go to the common heart. In the author's note at the end, I quote some words by Professor Julius Lester, and I want to close with them. I wrote them on a card, and I propped them on my desk, and they remained there for the entire 4 years that I worked on this novel. And they are this: history is not just facts and events. History is also a pain in the heart. And we repeat history until we are able to make another's pain in the heart our own. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to have time for a few questions. If you'd like to ask one, I'd love to hear it. Yes, sir.
I'd like to thank you for something. In Secret Life of Bees, you talked about August painting the house pink to raise May's heart, lift her heart. And I have used that over and over in workshops on assertiveness and self-esteem. And I can't believe I'm able to thank you for that.
You're welcome. Yes, sir.
I've been working on a project that I came across two women who wrote diaries in the Civil War, who also became well-known writers, one of whom lived in Charleston. Sarah Morgan Dawson, Frank Dawson's. And then Fannie Andrews from Georgia. Have you come across those two?
I regret to say I have not. Yeah. You should write the book so I can read it. Good. Good luck. All right. Good luck. That's great. Yes?
I'm curious, when you write historical fiction, there must be enormous facts and data and pieces of history that you gather. Organized and straight, and I imagine that you're in libraries or museums and places where you can't take things pieces or journals out. I'm just interested in the mechanics of how you store all that information so you can reference it later to put into your book.
I'm supposed to be repeating the questions for the wonderful people who are in the special collections section upstairs, so let me try to do that. How do I work with all the, a massive amount of facts and data and organize it and structurally manage it, I guess you're asking, correct? Okay. Well, I researched this for about 6 months before I started writing. And a lot of it was collecting books and reading, just lots of reading. I sometimes would read 6-7 hours a day, make notes, and I collected notebooks that I tried to organize this chaos in. And it really was chaotic, and that's really part of the process. It's brooding over the chaos. I mean, that's what God did to create the world, right? So we should take a page from that and brood over the chaos. And it feels sometimes like it's too much and too immense and you don't know what to do with it. I felt that way a lot. So I tried to put it in notebooks. I had 7 big notebooks of notes, and then they just kept growing. And I visited lots of places, Library of Congress, New York Historic Society, the Smithsonian, but I did my primary research in Charleston, visiting many libraries and historic houses. And I took pictures, and I just had so much, I thought I was going to drown. I think slowly, you just take your time, and slowly I began to create these huge, what shall I call them, pieces of poster board that I put up all around in my study, where I tried to map it out. And after a while of working with this for months and months, you begin to get a sense of what is what, the life of your characters and the chronology of the time and the historical background. I made maps, and then after a while you just have to put it all away and write your book. That's it. You just say, okay, you just go. And I wrote for 3.5 years after that, and I was constantly referring to all of this and looking things up. It was just a constant research project. I have no good answer for you. You just get in there and do it.
Did you find yourself reflecting on your own heritage of the women whose lineage you come from and touching on this and their relationship to the time and where we are now?
Of course I did. I thought often of my mother, my grandmother, who could not vote for much of her, when she came in the world. Women didn't have the right to vote when she was born. And I thought about a lot of things. My grandmother was a quilter. My maternal grandmother quilted, and I put a quilt in the story called a story quilt for her, for one reason. I think that it weighed on me a lot, the whole legacy of that and where we've come and where we're going. History is we are the sum of our history, I guess we could say, as a people, not just as women, but as a people and as a country. And it's good to stop and look at where we came from, because that's how we know who we are, and it tells us where we're going. And so that's why it's important to do what these women did and dare to change it.
I want to say right on.
Yeah, press on, my sister. We'll have to go there. Yes, ma'am.
I have a twofold question. First, I've read all your books and I love them, but my favorite is When the Heart Waits. Mm-hmm. Do you plan on ever writing a spiritual memoir again? And the second part is your husband, not your husband, is your son going to host a book club for us?
All right, I forgot to repeat your question. Y'all prompt me. The question is about When the Heart Waits and whether I'm going to write another spiritual memoir, and is my son going to host a book club? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I may have to get back to you on that one. I don't know. Well, I actually, I would say that Traveling with Pomegranates is a spiritual memoir. It's been called all kinds of things, a travel memoir, a mother-daughter story, a spiritual book. It has a spiritual core in it. It starts with where I left off in The Dance of the Dissident Daughter and tries to live that, take that story forward. And it was published in 2009. So I'm sure I'll revisit that again. I'm very compelled to write fiction, but also I'm pretty sure I'll write another memoir. I mean, I love to chronicle my own story. It's a need I have to take the contents of my life the best I can and shape them into some kind of narrative. I think story is the most healing thing. You know, their wonderful quote from Isaac Dinesen, you can bear anything if you can tell a story about it. And there's truth in that. It's a meaning maker. So yes, I probably will. Now, I'll have to talk to Bob about whether or not he's going to host a book club. In fact, I'm going to talk to Bob about co-authoring a book with me, really. Yes.
One of the many ways that your books touch me is through sort of a soul-making quality that seems to come for me when I am involved in your books. And then you were talking tonight about liberation and how Sarah's liberation is one kind and Hetty's is another kind. And so I just am curious, when you look around today, what women do you see that are particularly daring, particularly invested in that liberating soul-making?
The question is, what women in the contemporary time today do I think are particularly daring? I think many of them, we don't know their names. I think that there are many cracks in history and a lot of women have fallen through them, and that even happens today in the 24/7 news cycle. I think that we see them often in other countries too, not just this country, where there are many intrepid women breaking barriers and doing things. But I think of Malala, the Pakistani girl who fought for the right to have an education and was shot in the head for it. That's pretty brave. And then returned. I think of the women in Liberia who brought down a government. There's a striking documentary about that if you're interested. It's very moving. It's called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And these women stopped a dictator who was not just abusing power, but a human rights violations, and a handful of women brought him down. Women like that, I mean, they inspire us all, you know. Yes?
I just wanted to ask about, I love your way that you use colloquial phrases, colloquialisms, and I don't know that you got that from, like, reading letters. You think people would be rather stilted when they write, and I was wondering, were you getting it more from perhaps like songs are you know, for instance, you know, that Living on the Scarce Side of Mercy, did you just come up with that? You know, did you see that saying, that phrase somewhere that you were able to put that away at the right moment?
The question is about the colloquialisms in the book and where they come from, because often you don't see that in letters and journals written in the 19th century. So where does that come from? Words like, a phrase like living on the scarce side of mercy. You're right, that's not in the literature. In fact, if you read Sarah's journal, you would pull your hair out. I mean, it's written in the stilted 19th century language that's very difficult to follow and very pious. I mean, this was how people wrote then, in a very formal way too. That's what I meant by I had to just let her have her freedom, a freedom of voice, and I knew that she would have to, really, both voices would have to have a modern sensibility, and this is the novelist's prerogative. I tried to find a place where I could speak authentically in my character's voice, but at the same time give them this modern sensibility, because it's got to be identified with, you know. I'm all about my reader. And living on the scarce side of mercy, I mean, yeah, that just comes to you as you're writing. You have to trust what comes. And as you immerse yourself in the character, you know, she voices things, and you just try to listen to that part of yourself that's trying to give voice to her. And it helps to know your character really well. I don't exactly know where the voice of Hetty Handful comes from. I read a lot of slave narratives from the 19th century. I read them from the 1930s. And I read, you know, language from the quilting ladies of G's Bend. I remember the women from my childhood. But ultimately, you have to put that away and just find the character's unique voice. One more question? Yes, about.
Do you have any advice for aspiring want-to-be writers?
Do I have advice for aspiring would-be writers? Well, I will try, because there's so much one could say here, and I only have a soundbite to say it. So it's hard to know where to start, but I would say believe in what you're doing and doubt it at the same time. This is how I write. I would say read and read and read, and read really fine work, because it sets the bar really high in your mind, and it makes you think you could never do it. But it's working in there. Persist.
Press on,
sister. Yeah, and press on, exactly. Allow yourself to write badly. Everything I write starts out badly. Don't expect that you're going to sit down and write a masterpiece the first time out or the first week. You wouldn't expect to sit down and play Beethoven on the piano in a week, I don't think, unless you're a prodigy. And give yourself an apprenticeship. Take your time. Commit yourself to it. I mean, you know these things. It's in you, right? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I really appreciate you being here. And I hope I get to meet you at the signing.